Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. Your involvement makes a difference every week. And always remember, FYP.
Hey there, recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 381. Gosh, 381, Larry. Registry Matters. How are you tonight?
A little bit toasty. How are you?
Toasty. Do you go outside and rotate? Are you on a rotisserie, or do you bake one side and then the other?
It doesn't take long to bake one side, because remember, we have no clouds here.
We did talk about that. Can you imagine, Larry, that London has, what was it, 50 non-cloudy days in a year?
And we have 300 of them, and so isn't that quite a contrast?
Yes, it's inverted. Hey, so you were making a joke about being late. We were just getting rolling, and we were, whatever, 1 or 2 minutes late, and about this costing however many dollars per minute. So I was having a conversation with my kid this morning. We were on a walk around the neighborhood, and I was like, so you know, like, radio stations and TV stations, they are controlled by the FCC because there's this whole frequency spectrum thing. And he was like, huh? I was like, oh my God. So I was trying to explain to him, like, the whole curve that channel 4 doesn't just sit there, whatever the hertz of majigs, whatever for channel 4 is, but it doesn't just, like, peak right there. It's this whole big bell curve looking thing. And he was like looking at me like a deer in the headlights. He has no idea what anything that I was talking about was.
Has he ever listened to a radio in his life? Probably not.
Only when he would get in somebody else's car, I'm guessing, and then they turn on the radio. I don't, on the rarest of occasion, Larry, I will turn on something on the radio. Once or twice a year, maybe I turn on NPR in the car, but like never otherwise. I always have podcasts running in the car, or I'm listening to Pandora. Never.
Well, that's the way of the business. Most people don't listen to the radio except in their cars, and that's
true.
Shrinking.
Not very true. Well, hey, press the like, subscribe, 5-star review button, stars, notifications, and YouTube. You know what I'm saying. So, hey, what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have this fabulous outcome from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals that originated in the state of Alabama. It has to do with a parent's right to raise their own children. Also, we have a story from New Mexico. A long-time attorney was arrested and charged with smuggling drugs into a correctional facility. And then the case took a rather strange turn.
And I added to the end that Pennsylvania thing I told you about. But I'm just going to, like, read it, and it'll take us 30 seconds.
Sure.
The Supreme Court just told federal prosecutors, you cannot drag a defendant across the country to your favorite courthouse. You try a person where the crime happened, period. Larry explains why that principle could matter for the registered person community down the road. Patrons hear every episode early and completely ad-free. Get ahead of the conversation at patreon.com/registrymatters.
Cool. All right. Well, we have this story from your neck of the woods. It's from KRQE, not WKKK, not that channel?
No, not from KKK.
So this is KRQE News 13. You want to talk about the arrest of this prominent Albuquerque defense attorney who is accused, because all people are innocent until proven guilty, right?
Correct.
He's accused of trying to smuggle drugs into a New Mexico prison. What does this have to do with our issue? You know, FYP's airtime is extremely valuable, right?
It is, and we just lost 3 minutes of it because we were late starting.
So the attorney's name is Brian Pori. Is that the way I would pronounce it? Pori?
Well, I was going to say there is a connection. It'll just take us a few minutes to get there. There is a connection to our issue. But yes, Pori is the way to pronounce it.
All right, well, the story says that what appeared to be a typical client visit to the Cibola County Correctional Center ended with the attorney in handcuffs outside of a prison in Milan, New Mexico, on March 11th. Did I do Milan right, or is it Milan?
You did it correct.
Okay, so Milan. And so an officer stopped 64-year-old Brian Pori. The officer, if you want an attorney present while we speak, you can do so. Okay. And Mr. Pori responded with, what if I am an attorney? So here's a little clip about Mr. Pori.
Correctional Center.
About 100 Suboxone strips, okay?
I wouldn't know where to get Suboxone. They searched my stuff. My stuff is still in there, so I don't know who's had access to it.
Well, that response is kind of funny, but Mr. Pori is a long-time defense attorney. And KRQE has interviewed him over the years about a number of his high-profile cases. And in police body camera footage, he can be heard laughing, which you just heard, as the Milan officer told him he has been accused of trying to bring that Suboxone, which is apparently a prescription narcotic, into the Cibola County Correctional Facility. Now, I don't know what that is. Do you have any idea what that does?
Not the foggiest idea at all. I've never heard of it. But Pori repeatedly denied the accusation and told the officer that he was going back to his car after security told him he had too much money with him. And then Pori said,
I'm just off for 3 years.
Yeah.
And I've never been suspected of anything like this. And it's not true.
And then the prison official had another comment, and they said,
uh-oh, I think I broke it.
You broke it.
You had an eyeglass case.
Oh my God, it's trying to kill me tonight.
You had an eyeglass case. It's a soft eyeglass case, and they just opened it up to like...
All right, well, they opened it up and they found all those Suboxones in there, whatever they're called, and they just kind of fell out of the little eyeglass case. So that's when they say Pori fled. He just turned around and decided to split. He left his bag, his laptop, his legal work, and all that stuff there.
Now, and Pori was then arrested and taken back into the prison, this time as an inmate.
I just think it's outrageous.
Okay.
I think it's outrageous. I'm trying to come represent a client.
And this is what they do to him. So, yeah, they showed him they're getting locked up and all that.
I heard the cuffs clicking. That sounds like a very familiar sound.
Yes, it does. All right, well, the story says while waiting to be processed, he explored two legal arguments with the officer saying his fingerprints won't be found on the Suboxone packaging. And if there's no fingerprints on there and they don't take it from my immediate possession and control, it's a setup. Pori then told the officer that he was 2 weeks away from retirement. I think I'm pretty well respected among the judges in the U.S. District Court, and I'm going to tell everyone who can listen that I was falsely accused, said Mr. Pori. Do you think that that's a convincing argument for him to use?
No, I think that if I were on the Board of Bar Examiners, I would be very distressed over the way he handled that. But Pori was booked for bringing contraband onto prison grounds. When asked if he knows what day it is by a nurse, which is part of the, you know, they book a person, they do a medical questionnaire. Pori responded, it's March 11th, 2026, a date which will live in infamy. Now, I wonder where that came from.
Really? He said a date that will live in infamy. That's funny. Okay.
And then KRQ spoke with Brian, Mr. Pori, on the phone, and he said he would never bring contraband into a prison. The state's disciplinary board filed a petition asking the Supreme Court of our state to suspend Pori from practicing law.
There was a follow-up story recently on KRQE, and it says, now investigators are accusing Pori of working with inmates for years to get contraband past guards. Now, months after that arrest, a newly released federal search warrant claims that this isn't the first time Pori was accused of trying to smuggle drugs into the facility. Investigators said that Pori sent a legal letter to inmate Reynaldo Vargas in December. Legal letters are considered confidential between attorneys and clients, but when Vargas opened it, investigators said a jail guard noticed the paper had stains or odd colors and an abnormal texture. The mail was confiscated and sent to the FBI, which said it tested positive for Suboxone. Investigators cracked the case by looking at phone calls between Poirier and Vargas, then using search warrants to get text messages between Vargas's friends. Prosecutors said that led authorities to search Poirier at the prison in March.
And then the story takes that twist. This is how it begins to connect to our issue. The feds continued their investigation. A story that was published June 9th in the Oregon Mountain News. It states, because Poirier provided legal representation for multiple clients held at Cibola County Correctional Center, investigators used a filter team to avoid reviewing privileged attorney-client communications. I don't exactly know what that means, but that's what the story says. Federal investigators said FBI special agents later conducted a preliminary view of forensic images from Poirier's cell phone and laptop. Now remember, he bolted and left his stuff.
I remember.
A review of the laptop, agents identified several images depicting suspected CSAM material. And I hate using that, but it's the most polite way I know how to say it on a family program. So that's what they found, images.
So they found naughty images on his computer?
Yes, according to the FBI, Child Exploitation and Human Trafficking Task Force confirmed images identified during the preliminary review depicted CSAM, and that's Child Sexual Abuse Material for the acronym. And the complaint describes the suspected CSAM involving prepubescent boys and girls, including investigators believe their age to be 6 to 10 years old. The complaint says the images were found as Telegram media files, cached files on Poirier's laptop. Investigators wrote that the Telegram application also was found on Poirier's cell phone and laptop. What are cached files? It's kind of like cashing a check.
You caught me off guard with that one. No, cached files. We talked about this the other day. It's when you go to a web page and there are images there. So to make the browser experience faster, it will save them in a cache. Like back in your ute, you would store your gold from your pirating days and you would store them in a cache, right? Do you remember those days?
Yes, I do very well.
Okay, so that's a different kind of cache than cashing a check. But so they found stuff in Telegram too? Dude, he's doomed. So Telegram, don't you use Telegram with your boss?
We did, but we discontinued it for some reason.
Okay, because that's... I have heard that they don't have the best kind of security, but it's a very popular app. And if you're receiving text messages from people over Telegram that have that kind of material in it, dude, you're doomed. And then you would save it on your phone or just those images being there. They got to get saved somewhere, and they would get saved on your phone so that they can be recalled more quickly. Moving along, though, a deputy U.S. Marshal wrote in the complaint that the location of the files and the way cached images are created and retained gave investigators probable cause to believe the laptop's user knowingly accessed and possessed the images.
And after the feds took over the investigation, the state contraband, the introduction of the contraband into the correctional facility was dismissed in the Cibola County Magistrate Court without prejudice, April 6. And according to the notice of dismissal filed in the state's case, this dismissal was filed without prejudice, and therefore they can bring these charges back later. But I don't think they will, because if the feds have got him, that's going to be more than enough.
The story says the federal case also prompted disciplinary proceedings before the New Mexico Supreme Court. On May 14th, the Supreme Court denied the petition for summary suspension but allowed Poirier to continue practicing law only under supervision while disciplinary proceedings continued. The court also ordered that Poirier could only meet with clients at a prison or jail with an approved supervising attorney and could not deliver personal items to clients during prison or jail visits. So where is he at now?
Well, after the feds took over and the CSAM complaint was filed, disciplinary counsel and Poirier jointly asked the Supreme Court to revoke his supervised practice status and impose summary suspension pending the outcome of the criminal case or disciplinary proceedings. Poirier is being held at the Doña Ana County Detention Center, pretrial under federal jurisdiction, and according to a jail booking report. He was booked June 1st, and he's held without bond, and I checked as of this evening. We're recording. He's still there. Now, to all you Trumpsters that get so mad that your people were held, this is common in the federal system. You get arrested on a federal charge. You're very commonly detained, even though there's a presumption of innocence and all this kind of stuff. So all the people that are mad about pretrial detention, please focus it on the system, not just the fact that it's your people were held, because this is the system.
Well, then, in your opinion, in your non-professional legal professional opinion, Uncle Larry, what do you see happening?
Well, I hope that justice is done. There's rumors have swirled for a long time. But if he's guilty of these offenses, he has disgraced the legal profession and should be held accountable. But having said that, he's also entitled to the presumption of innocence until he's convicted or decides to enter a plea of guilty. But where it really bothers me is that I used to do professional visits as an attorney paralegal, and they afforded us a lot of leeway in terms of getting into facilities because we were supposedly screened and we're going to respect the boundaries. If Mr. Puri was doing the things that have been alleged here, he is the one who causes the ones of us who will not even give an inmate a match. That's where they start trying to tempt you. They'll say, I just need a book of matches. And if they they get you hooked on that, then they escalate from there. If he did these things, he is the reason why we go through such grief trying to get into a facility. Because you can't trust anyone. An officer of the court with 30 plus years of practice should be trustworthy. But I'm afraid that with the feds on the case, they've probably got him. You know, they took the case thinking that they could win it.
Something we didn't talk about here is that for the overwhelming majority of contraband that ends up in prisons, it comes from you people on the outside. It does not come from like visitation where they freaking cavity search you when you leave visitation. It comes from staff and attorneys bringing stuff in. And honestly, I'm just ignorant. I don't really know of that being a really common thing, is that attorneys bringing stuff in.
Well, then how else does it get in other than the attorneys?
The staff.
Oh, no. They wouldn't hire anyone who would.
I don't even want to go into it. Staff are the ones that bring it in. I'm telling you.
Well, it's a sad day. He's too old to be in this predicament. It's a disgrace to a legal career if the disciplinary board disbars him. And also, he's made it more difficult for people to do their jobs if he did these things. It's really sad because we need to be able to get it out and see our clients with very little scrutiny. And people like this cause the correctional management to want to snoop where they don't have any business. But if you can't honor the rules, then they have to snoop.
Well, it's always that one person that ruins it for everybody. It's why we can't have nice things, Larry.
Well, I never so much as provided a match stem to anybody, and they tried, but nope, we don't bring anything in here. I think the most I brought was a magazine, and I would show the magazine, hey, is this permissible? And if it is, I'm going to give it to my client.
A listener in Missouri fills out a required travel form. That form triggers a notification that gets him permanently banned from the country where his wife and children live. Fill it out. Lose your family. Refuse. Face prosecution. Larry and Andy dig into whether that counts as unconstitutional compelled speech. Registry Matters is a nonprofit. Your support funds the fight at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well, we've got an 11th Circuit en banc decision here to discuss. The case is Henry versus the world. Henry versus Sheriff of Tuscaloosa County.
Yes, this is a win, and it's a three-peat at that. This case was won at the trial court. Then it was decided favorably by the 11th Circuit with a three-judge panel a year or so back. And now it's been decided again by the full court sitting en banc. And we last discussed this case on episode 339 back in April of 2025.
So almost exactly a year ago. So now I've been told before we even started that this one has you in a good mood, which is not very usual.
I'm not usually happy, and I'll admit that, but for once we're walking through a case that actually reads like good news, although it's a little bit weakened by the full court, but it's still good news.
All right, so I'm going to, hang on, I got to go over to my Google Calendar and mark this. I got to mark this date because it seldom happens that Larry is in a good mood, but we will move on while I do that.
Well, I'm confident I can throttle all that optimism before we're done, aren't you?
I'm sure of that.
Because that's my job. But the very first line of the opinion by Judge Rosenbaum, writing on behalf of the court, this case is about a fundamental right of parents to live with their children, a right that the Supreme Court has described as perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests that the 14th Amendment secures. And that's a quote from Troxell versus Granville. So right out of the gate, the court tells you it doesn't even need to legislate or invent any new law because there's precedent already.
Well, tell us about a Troxell versus Granville.
Well, that case was decided in 2000, and it was touted as a landmark decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. It established that fit parents have a fundamental constitutional right under the 14th Amendment to make decisions regarding the care, custody, and control of their children. Imagine that, a parent having a right to be a part of their child's life. Who would have ever thought of that?
I can't even imagine. All right, well, before we get into the case, tell me about this dude. Who is Bruce Henry? You got to always watch out for people with two first names, too, by the way.
Yes, well, Mr. Henry pled guilty in 2013 to one count of possessing child porn, and he had never been convicted of a sexual offense prior to that. At the time of his arrest in 2011, he possessed two videos and 348 photos of prepubescent and adolescent girls, which were downloaded from the internet. Henry's collection focused on girls of a very young age and included depictions of sadomasochism and bestiality.
I'm sorry, can you describe what those are, Larry? Sorry, I'm just kidding.
I think I'm going to pass.
What was his original? You're going to pass. Okay. What was his original sentence?
He received 70 months in prison and he served.
Come on, man. 70 months is not that long.
And he served about 5 years. He got it in March of 2018. And the opinion says he completed a qualified sex offender treatment program as well as an individual and group counseling. He attended weekly Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings. He maintained a steady job, attends church, and volunteers. This is a picture of a man who served his time and is doing everything the system asks. And then in August 2021, he and his wife had a son. And because of the Alabama Act, he cannot sleep with his own house with that child.
So now, hold on if you would, because I read further down and it says he had a couple of incidents while on supervised release. Was Henry in good, was he a good vehicle for this? Was he a good candidate? Like plaintiff shopping, right?
That's a fair question. And I'm not going to hide it because the court didn't hide it. The opinion tells us, quote, despite these restrictions, following supervised release, Henry in two instances accessed prawn. In July 19th, he admitted during a polygraphed interview that he had used Amazon Fire Stick to view prawn. The forensic exam found no saved images, but he had viewed images with, quote, titles indicating they were of young or teenage females. So, yes, he was looking at prawn while he was under supervision.
That doesn't sound like a good candidate, then. It doesn't sound like a good strategy for success, so to speak.
No, and it gets worse. He, quote, according to the court, actively sought out images of teen girls and children posed in sexual positions. Then in December 2019, he used his wife's phone to search for prawn images. His probation officer filed to revoke, and the district court declined, instead extending his supervised release from 60 months to 96 months. running through March of 2026. Since December 19, he has had no violations. So the question is, do those two incidents defeat the fundamental right? According to the court, no. Legally, they're beside the holding. But what I can see is they make him a weaker, unsympathetic vehicle. And of course they do. I absolutely will admit that if I could have found a better challenger, I would have.
Well, then let's talk about the act itself. What does it actually do to him day to day?
Well, it's complicated. That's where you have to read the mechanics out loud because you can't make it up. The act prohibits a sex offender from, quote, residing or conducting an overnight visit with a minor unless the offender is the parent, grandparent, step-parent, sibling, or step-sibling of the minor. Sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah, because he is the parent of the kid, right?
So then there's your exemption. But then you're that's your relief for parents, except for my favorite sentence where the whole opinion of the court says, those exemptions though are substantially less inclusive than they appear at first glance. That's because Section 15-20A-11, subsection D's exception itself has five exceptions. So there's five exceptions within the exception.
Right, so there's exceptions. So it's kind of like my never drive alone, especially if you go by where minors are. So like, yes. Don't ever do it, but then you can't do it extra.
Yes. So an exception with five exceptions stuffed inside it. you write a headline exemption for parents and then quietly claw it back so the relief is narrower than it looks. An exception number four catches Henry because his sex offense involving a child includes offenses involving child porn. So the parent exemption evaporates for him under the exceptions. You can't make this stuff up. There's an exception, but he doesn't qualify because they've got five more exceptions within the exception.
Sure. And what counts as residing or an overnight visit? Because those sound like they could mean almost anything.
Oh, well, they do define it. And that's the part that'll make your head spin. Under Alabama law, you reside somewhere if you're habitually or systematically present there. Now, I have no idea what that means. As a baseline, you reside there if you spend more than 4 hours a day, on three or more consecutive days. Now, I'm trying to figure that out. I'm at least of average intelligence. So if you spend 4 hours a day on three or more consecutive days, okay, I think I got that. And more than 4 hours a day on 10 or more aggregate days in a month. Now, who in the heck could track that? How would you do that? And an overnight visit happens between the hours of 10:30 p.m. and 6 a.m. Any presence at all in that window. So let me read you the court's own summary because it's brutal in plainness. Section 15-20-A, subsection D, prevents Henry from being present in the same home as his son at any time between the hours of 10:30 p.m. and 6 a.m. That's one scenario. The second scenario, for more than 4 hours a day on three consecutive days. That's the second scenario. For more than 4 hours or a day on 10 or more days during calendar month. That's the third one. And the fourth one, in any other circumstances where he is habitually or systematically present in his son's home. I can't even figure this out. He can't sleep in his own house between 10:30 and 6. Please, there's time. Can you at least admit this is funny?
This is not funny. And is there any way out of it, any process to earn his way back?
There's no off-ramp ever for the rest of your life. And I'm not even editorializing. That's the court's interpretation. They say these restrictions are permanent. Alabama law affords no off-ramp to Henry or anyone else. The act contains no mechanism for offenders to challenge the prohibitions on residing or staying overnight with their own children. And that restriction persists for the rest of the offender's life. And then the kicker. So even if the offender lives a law-abiding life for decades after their conviction and later has a child, they cannot live with that minor child, nor can they seek relief from the prohibition.
So and this thing calls itself child safety, and it's not punishment, of course. Of course it's not punishment. It's a civil regulatory scheme, right?
Correct. The stated purpose, and I'll wave at it, it's not to punish sex offenders, but to protect the public and, most importantly, promote child safety. A lifetime separation of a fit parent from his own newborn with no possible relief for anyone ever gets labeled protection. That wasn't the hook here, but it's the sting here for sure.
So walk me through the procedural history. How do we even get to en banc? And can you remind us even what that means?
Well, I think there's like a dozen or 18, however many I counted, but I've lost my memory of the number of justices, the judges on the 11th Circuit. So for expediency, you normally put a case before a three-judge panel. Now, why do we do that? Because you can never have a tie with a three-judge panel, can you?
Probably not, unless somebody votes kind of like, eh, maybe.
So a three-judge panel is going to get an appeal that goes up from a district court. And then if the aggrieved parties, either of them don't like that, they can ask the full court to hear it, which is extremely rare. Because if they granted that en banc full review, it wouldn't be too long. Everybody would want one because that would give them another bite at the apple. So that's what it is. But after the son was born, Henry sued under Section 1983 to stop or enjoin enforcement. Both sides moved for summary judgment, and the district court granted Henry's motion. Now, this was probably an okay case for it because it's pretty straightforward. It's all based on the law, so I don't have any beef about summary judgment. It declared the prohibition facially unconstitutional and universally enjoined its future enforcement. That was at the district court.
Just to go back one quick thing, 1983, that is a constitutional challenge, right?
Yes, it's a section of U.S. Code 42, Section 1983. Title 42, Section 1983 is where you sue for constitutional violations, yes.
That's cool. All right. Of course, though, Alabama appealed all of this?
They did. And then a panel of the 11th Circuit affirmed in part the district judge and reversed in part and vacated and remanded. The panel ruled that prohibition as applied burdened Henry's fundamental right to live with and raise his child, and it didn't survive strict scrutiny. But on the facial ruling and the universal injunction, the panel said the district court had erred because it had gone too far, and they vacated the total injunction. But basically, he had a good win at the with the three-judge panel.
And so then Alabama requested an en banc review.
They did. Now, remember, I can't help myself. This is the people who tell you when they run for office how they're guarding your resources so carefully, and they don't believe in wasting a penny. Now, they're already in this case, according to our paralegal. They're already in the case for our side. It's already above $500 million in billable hours, which means that their side is already above that, probably a couple times above that. So they're already spending money, and they're so frugal. But the full court, they did the request, and the full court granted, and they vacated the panel opinion and took it up en banc on one question only. That question is or was, would applying Alabama Code Section 15-28-11D to bar Bruce Henry from residing or conducting overnight visits with his minor child violate his right to substantive due process?
And then how does the court frame the legal test?
Well, it's two steps, two tracks. Step one, is this a fundamental right? A right is fundamental if it's objectively deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of our liberty. And I don't think they're going to have any trouble passing that one. And I don't even like, where'd you find that word at? Glucksburg scaffolding.
The Glucksburg scaffolding?
Yes.
Come on, man. That's everyone. I guarantee everybody listening to the program right now knows what the Glucksburg scaffolding is.
I don't know that. I'm retarded. I'll know, but I'm not going to make you sit through the whole doctrinal machinery. Step two, apply the levels of the proper level of scrutiny. If it's a fundamental right, and here this part matters, the government action that encumbers the right is presumptively wrongful, and the government bears the burden to show that the action is narrowly tailored to serve a compelling state interest. That's strict scrutiny. If it's not fundamental, then it's a rational basis, which the government always, almost always wins. So I think they're going to be able to meet this test. But there's another off-ramp for the state that we'll get back to.
So the court put this on the fundamental track.
It did, and it did so emphatically. It relied on Meyer versus Nebraska from 1923, which is a 100-year-old precedent, the right to establish a home and bring up children, calling it perhaps the oldest of the fundamental interest. A whole footnote of cases, and I won't even read them all, but there's a whole string citation there of how important it is to allow families to raise their children. Now, remember, this is also from the part of the country that says a child needs a mommy and a daddy. You hear that all the time in the Bible Belt, right?
I have heard that a time or two.
Yes. Well, this is the same people that say that, and they pledge that that's what's wrong with our country. That's what's wrong with child misbehavior. And yet they separate them by law from a mommy and a daddy, which they claim that they need. Now, folks, please call your representatives and senators in Alabama and ask them to square this. I didn't vote for them, but you can ask them, why do you say that a child needs a mommy and a daddy, and then you make a law that says they can't be with their mommy and daddy? I would like that to be explained.
Now, Alabama's argument was interesting. They didn't say the state can regulate. They said these parents have no right at all.
Well, that's exactly what they said, and the court didn't find that very compelling. Alabama also argued that entire classes of parents have no fundamental rights at all because they committed state-defined misconduct years before their children were even born. And the court answered, quote, parents, even those who've committed state-defined misconduct, enjoy the fundamental right to live with their children. And so, quote, Bruce Henry, who was convicted of possessing images of child porn and has served his sentence, and has a child and wife, has a fundamental right to a son. Now, also, this is in the Bible Belt where people claim that they forgive people. So I'm fit to be tied. What is wrong with you people in the Bible Belt?
Now, does this mean we won? Is that what we're saying here? We won?
Well, not exactly. This is where I get to bring people down. This is where I earn my keep. Read the very next sentence with me. This does not mean Alabama can't regulate or even abrogate that right. But to do so, Alabama must show that the legislation is narrowly tailored to further its compelling interest in the safety of children. And then the line that tells you the whole game. Quote, we explain why Supreme Court precedent, our history and tradition, and the fundamental nature of the right of a parent to live with their children all require us to conclude that Henry enjoys a fundamental right to live with his children. Then we remand to the panel to take further actions consistent with this opinion, which is basically opening the door for them to say, well, here's why he should be deprived of that fundamental right.
Now, what they did, though, is they recognized the right and then handed it off?
They did, because they remanded it because this fight isn't over. It was just moved back to the lower courts. The court says flat out, the fact that parents have a fundamental right to live with their children does not resolve this appeal because Alabama has articulated a compelling reason for its law, the safety of children. So we remand this case to the panel to consider the best way to proceed. Recognizing the right and winning the case are two different animals. What they won today is the right and the burden shifts. The government now carries the burden and must narrowly tailor. The burden shift is the real prize that we won. But it only matters if the court actually makes the state meet it. And this hasn't happened yet.
And the magic words are still on the table?
Yes, child safety, like I've said for 8 years now. The government can do almost anything if it narrowly tailors it. There are people who should be deprived of children. But the funny thing is we already have processes. Most states, if not all, have a Child Protective Services Department or something similarly named. And they already have a mechanism to deprive this parent of their contact with their children if they have enough evidence. It already exists. So, but the magic word child safety is still sitting on the table. That's the exact phrase courts use to justify anything, and it's unresolved. So we go back to court.
What do you expect to happen now that it's been remanded?
On remand, the panel will likely apply strict scrutiny and hold the categorical no off-ramp ban is not narrowly tailored. But I'm cautioning you, Alabama, based on their track record, we've got all this fight now. It's going to fight the tailoring point, and the case is not over. And here's my other prediction. Watch what Alabama does on remand, and both legally and legislature in Montgomery. A well-counseled legislature probably doesn't consider repealing the ban. They will likely just weaken the categorical bar into a discretionary one that's much harder to attack, and they'll give a sliver of people an off-ramp and say, hey, it doesn't apply to everybody, and they'll make us keep litigating.
But then also there was a dissent in it as well.
There was. I read carefully Judge Pryor, who's notoriously considered to be an extreme right-winger, filed a dissent joined by Newsom, Branch, and Lagoa, and partially joined by Luck. Can you imagine a judge named Luck?
You probably wouldn't be lucky to have Luck as your judge, I'm guessing.
The dissent is the roadmap that the state will cite on any petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'll note this is exactly the kind of split that the Supreme Court loves to take up. This is a well-developed case, more or less, and by the time that it gets back, it will have been developed about the narrow tailoring, and this is the kind of thing that the Supreme Court would likely dive into, could take up.
Well, you know, always big picture. Does this help anybody besides Wichmaduke's name? I forget who he is here. Henry? Does this help anybody but him?
No. The panel already vacated the universal injunction, so this is as applied relief to Henry. It benefits only the named plaintiff. Everybody else has to bring their own case or ride the precedent when we finally have one. This binds three states if it holds. You know, if we finally win it and they don't take it to the Supreme Court, this only binds Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. But the rest of you can cite this if you have stupid legislatures that enact this kind of thing. You can cite this as being persuasive, but don't get giddy outside the 11th Circuit because this has no power outside the 11th Circuit.
Would this apply to people on supervision, or is this only those past that point? Because that was one of my conditions.
I think that the people under supervision are going to have a tougher challenge. Not to say they don't have fundamental rights. They do. But the fact that you're still being punished, most courts look at you with less sympathy. It's just reality of life.
So what's the bottom line for this for us?
The bottom line is it's a mixed result, and I mean that precisely. I'm genuinely pleased that the en banc 11th Circuit looked at the ban that keeps the father out of his own home and said it burdens fundamental parental right and demanded strict scrutiny. That's good, and that's real, and it's a good thing, but I won't call it a real win because they did not strike the act down. They recognized and basically they punted it back to give Alabama a chance to justify the restriction. And believe me, they will, because Governor Ivey, she signed this thing with a lot of pride, and she's going to say we need to keep our children safe down here in Alabama.
You got to learn to say chirrins.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the government of Alabama at this point? Has your opinion changed since we discussed this on episode 339?
Run but the strangest collection of misfits, Looney Tunes, since the advent of the Third Reich.
So, no, my opinion has not changed very much. I think the Gipper said it best.
Very well.
What happens when you call your parole officer's supervisor to complain? Larry lays out exactly why that move can backfire spectacularly, especially if you are a frequent flyer in the system. It is the kind of frank, nobody-else-will-say-it guidance that defines this show. At higher patron levels, you can even get one-on-one time with Larry himself. Start at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well then, we have a good news, everyone, out of the state of Pennsylvania. I'm just going to read the article and we can kind of beat it around for a couple minutes. Over the past year, Parcel has run a campaign to hold the Pennsylvania State Police accountable to a law then Governor Wolf signed in 2018 requiring PSB, the Pennsylvania State Police, to implement a telephonic verification system for Pennsylvania's Megan Law registrants in tiers 2 and 3. Those required to verify their information 2 to 4 times a year. After months of getting the runaround from PSP, we escalated to the governor's office and the House Judiciary Committee. When that didn't work, we escalated further, calling on state representatives Emily Kincaid, a Democrat from Allegheny County, and John Schlegel, I guess, and that's a Republican from Lebanon. Like all the way in the Middle East, Larry? Lebanon?
Sure.
All right. So ask those two legislators to intervene. During the PSP budget hearing on March 12, 2026, Representative Kincaid directly called out the acting commissioner for the agency's failure to implement the required system. Like his staff for the past year, he was unable to answer the question. Representative Schlegel followed up in writing with PSP and learned that over the past 8 years, only 520 eligible registrants had been approved for telephone registration out of more than 8,000 potentially eligible. We then launched a messaging campaign to the PA General Assembly. If the PSB cannot implement a simple telephone verification system in 8 years, why should they receive more funding in the forthcoming budget cycle? I think that particular quote, Larry, would resonate with you.
Well, I like it. Actually, I like all of this because we have a similar law here that's been ignored for more than the number of years. So I might just have to confer with those people and parcel and figure out how to do what they did and maybe engage them to do the same thing here. But yes, this is good stuff. I don't think they're going to cut any budgeting in the budgeting cycle, but it is funny to kick this around for sure, because the law says to create this system and they haven't done it for 8 years. They haven't done it for, let's say, 2013. So we're 13 years and haven't done it here.
It just doesn't sound like it's that hard. You stand up a phone number and you put a person on the other end and they can look up the person and they can click the check boxes and done.
You're missing the point, though. They don't want you to be in compliance. They're looking for a mechanism to arrest people. You're missing the whole point. This is not about compliance. It's about arrests.
But the people, we got arrested for breaking the law. They're breaking a law and they're not being held accountable for breaking a law.
Well, they are being held accountable. They didn't have any idea until this was brought to their attention. But Representative Kincaid and Representative Schlegel are holding them accountable, thankfully.
So I have a quick little, they put it on their webpage. Here's a little 28-second clip of what a call looks like. And I hope this plays.
State Police, Megan Zoll.
Hi, my name's calling to register on a recorded line.
Do you have a SID number? And do you have any changes that you're making?
I don't.
Okay, good. Just making sure. Okay, and then can you please go ahead with the PIN number? Okay, so I'm going ahead and click verify. Okay, you have been verified. You are successful and everything's complete.
Like, how complicated is that?
It's not complicated, but again, they don't want to do it.
We have a listener from Pennsylvania. He says that because the police use in-person updates to do interrogations.
That I have heard in other jurisdictions. I have heard that, yes.
All right. Well, that sounds pretty cool, though. That sounds like that's good news for the potentially 8,000 people that are eligible for it.
Well, it's funny that it took them 8 years. It's not funny, it's sad, but 8 years, and they only had 500 that were
520.
We're enrolled. 520. Yeah. Isn't that great? And they,
but you shouldn't have to be quote unquote approved. You should be a tier 2 or tier 3 and you dial the digits. Like, done.
That's correct. But see, this is a good question to call out when they talk about needing more money. Say, well, wouldn't you need less money if you let people do things online and on the phone? Wouldn't that make labor resources more available? Do you really need more money? But see, this is political game. We need more money. And nobody wants to shorten the amount of work done because the more they can make it complicated, the easier it is to arrest people for technical violations.
Now, I'm going to say some technical, like, gobbledygook computer stuff. I could build an N8N workflow using AI by the end of tomorrow, and this would be solved.
Why don't you offer that to the PSP?
No, I'm good there. Anything else before we head out, Larry?
We have a new patron to recognize.
Oh, we do. Gosh darn it. I totally forgot. Can you call it out? I could go look it up if you need me to.
Well, I can, if you can do some monologue while I'm looking it up.
No, it's Joseph. Joseph K. has become a patron. Thank you very much, Joe or Joseph. And I did say hi to him. He showed up on the Discord server just shortly after he became a patron. So thank you very much. And hey, Larry, do you still take calls from people that are patrons?
I do indeed. If they're at the right level, but I do have one strange request. You got to answer your phone.
I'm sorry. I call you. Why would anybody want to answer their phone?
I have to build up to having a bandwidth of time and psychologically prepared. And I call you. I don't know when I'm going to call you. I call you when the opportunity presents itself. And if I can't get you, then you lost your chance. So if you request a callback, I'm happy to do it. Just make yourself available.
Fantastic. Well, please head over to registrymatters.co to find show notes and links everywhere you need to go. registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Old-fashioned voicemail messages at 747-227-4477. And as we were just discussing, patreon.com/registrymatters. And you too can become a patron just like Joseph did. And it is so very much appreciated. Look, we're here every week-ish, you know, except for when Larry's got, I don't know, he's got to wash his hair. He's got a headache that night. He can't go out on a date with me. And we're what you would call independent content creators. We do this mostly to help the PFR community. And I know Sandy's in there. Every time we say PFR, she's screaming at us, but that is why we are here. It's not by any chance that we're going to get like become millionaires. We're not Joe Rogan getting signed by Spotify for $100 million. We just do this to try to help the people out because there's this massive lack of information, you know?
Indeed. And we do get a small amount of money out of it, but it's so small compared to the effort goes into it. And I'm grateful that we have the generous patrons, but we need a whole lot more of them.
It should be. There are quite a lot of us. All right. Well, stay out of trouble. Stay cool. You know, hydrate and rotate. Definitely got to rotate to keep the cooking even there, Larry. We wouldn't want to have you oddly cooked.
Indeed.
Have a good night, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.